Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Hey, and welcome again to another great edition of the NIDS View. Yes, you are not listening to Adam Lowther, so don't worry. Your hearing hasn't been affected here by the recent storms. No, this is Curtis McGiffin. I am hosting today, along with my colleague, Dr. Jim Petrosky. And it is just the dynamic duo today, as Adam is out on assignment. And so we're looking forward to a great conversation. To get you wherever you are going as you're listening to us, presumably in your car, trying to avoid traffic as much as you can. We're going to kind of talk about just a couple of different things. They're a little linked together, but we're going to stay pretty focused. And as we get started, Jim, how are you doing today? It's good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, so I want to apologize up front to the audience because I do have a bit of a cold, so you may hear a little bit difference in my voice. And I'll try to cut the mic, but I apologize up front. But if you're on the YouTube channel, you'll see that I came equipped, because it's fall, wearing my really cool NIDS jacket that I think we're going to eventually get onto our merch site, and my really cool NIDS hat, all together just in preparation for this nice day that we're having here in Ohio. So go for it there, Curtis.
That's awesome. I'm sure cool is a perception in the eye of the beholder. But hey, you know, you're rocking it, and I appreciate that. So as we're recording here for this episode here in early October, we had a what I think is a remarkable, point in history, recent history, for lack of a better term, the NNSA, or the National Nuclear Security Administration, finally announced that they have produced their first plutonium pit in 35 years. So this is a remarkable achievement, I think. We rack out all the applause here. If I had horns and confetti, I would be throwing them and blowing them in the air right now. So this is, as I said, a remarkable thing, because we've actually finally achieved something here in our modernization effort. So this is a plutonium pit. It's part of the W87-1 warhead, which is going to be used in the new LGM-35 Alpha Sentinel ICBM, which will be, hopefully deployed before mid-century. And so we got to get started on building the warheads as we prep those things. And so I thought there was nobody better to talk about this than our own Dr. Petrosky. And so I wanted to bring this up today and kind of center our conversation today on this plutonium pit production. I have some questions that I kind of want to get us started with, Jim, but I know you'll probably have a preamble, but maybe you can start with my question. And I think the first question I'm going to ask you is, what are the plutonium pits used for?
Okay, well, that's a straightforward answer. So the plutonium pits, first of all, the plutonium pits, and I'll skip the preamble just because you set me up for one, just to be contrary today. No, the plutonium pits are basically the fundamental trigger, if you will, to the nuclear weapon. They are part of two types of weapons. There's gun type weapon. There's an implosion type weapon, and a plutonium pit is primarily the main trigger item to make the implosion weapon function correctly. And the reason why it's important to have the implosion kind of weapon is you can build it into a two-stage weapon, which allows you to create larger or smaller nuclear weapons as needs to be designed, based upon the availability, of course, the materials and the design. And we don't talk about design here, but those two fundamental concepts are there. And the reason plutonium, for our audience, just to know, plutonium is very useful in this fashion, because it provides for a few extra neutrons that you get, unlike you would have with uranium, and it it really functions well in this trigger piece. However, it couldn't be used in, say, a gun-type weapon. This is why we came up with the implosion-style weapon, because the gun-type weapon is made and designed based upon the availability of neutrons, which will lead me to the second piece of this, and maybe I'm going a little deeper than you wanted, Curtis. But the main requirement for the with the plutonium is that it has something called spontaneous fission, which means the plutonium will fission and give off a neutron. And when you design a weapon, you have to get the neutrons at the right time. And so going backwards here to what I would have had as a preamble is this is an incredible feat for two reasons. Everybody focuses on the pit. They go, there's a pit and it's for the nuclear bomb. And that's really cool. And I agree. I've been waiting to see this for, I don't know, 30 years. I would have loved to be at the pit manufacturing facility when this occurred. But the other piece that most people don't think about is the incredible effort in metallurgy, in science, in safety and analysis that must go into designing the pit to function exactly as it's supposed to be. And our national labs really put an incredible effort into that. And so that, and we'll probably get into that a little bit deeper, but I wanted to put up front the fact that our great United States puts the effort into rebuilding the capability, rebuilding the expertise, rebuilding the safety fundamentals, et cetera, that go into that so that we do this safely and securely is already a strategic message to our adversaries that, no kidding, we mean it seriously when we say we're modernizing our systems and we know how to do it. And I think that was the most exciting thing when I saw this article. Now, there's other things about the article I'll talk about, but I'll let Curtis sort of interject here because I'm sure he has some things to talk about there.
Well, I agree, Jim. And I think that, you know, other things that mark this is so interesting. So this certainly marks an end of the presidential edict from the Obama administration that said, you know, nothing new, right? No new warheads that was laid out with regard to the 2010 nuclear posture review. And that was the 2018 nuclear posture review that sort of began this, the mandate for the 80 pits per year. And so it's taken about 6 years to finally create the first one, right? So only 79 more to go to get to the first year's requirement. So that is something that we should, to mark. But to your point, Jim, we did have to rebuild, this entire apparatus that was more or less shut down. I think the last pit was built in 2012, which surprises me that it was that late. It was probably some variation thereof, but we certainly didn't have a demand, since the end of the Cold War, like we are undergoing now. So let me ask this, because I think our listeners are probably pretty curious about some of these little. So I'm going to sort of take some of the layman questions here. These are the things that, you know, if I was just, you know, Joe Citizen, wondering where my tax dollars are going and what this does, you know, these are the questions that I might ask. Like, Jim, how long does it take to make one of these?
Well, that's a good question now. Okay. So, you know, it's, well, because we started this process, you know, I'm not sure where. I have not been in that facility for a long time. I know we toured a plutonium facility roughly 2015-16 timeframe, I think. That's plutonium pit facility. I may be wrong. Some of our listeners can call me and tell me I'm absolutely wrong in there. But it's not, it, you know, your question, and the reason why I stumble on that is it depends what you mean. Remember that plutonium is not naturally occurring on Earth. We actually have to get plutonium by interacting uranium inside of a reactor, and then you end up creating, and that's right, we create transmutation, the plutonium. Now, I'm not sure in these pits, but eventually we're going to have to get there where we're pulling plutonium from somewhere. And that's done, you know, Savannah River site. We have a reactor that's designed to create the plutonium. But the whole, I mean, the whole thread here, and it's why that's an interesting question, why, you know, it's sort of like the question, you know, how long does it take to walk? You know, the old Chinese proverb, you know, it depends on what you mean. How long does it take to make it? So I got to put it in a reactor. I got to pull it out of a reactor. It's radioactively hot. I've got to let it cool. I've got to chemically separate the plutonium from the uranium that's there. I've got to make sure it's of the right grade. I may need to do some grade change or grade reduction to make sure it's of the right grade, because not all plutonium is good. Only the fissile plutonium is good. And the non-fissile plutonium is bad. That's why we have weapons grade plutonium and weapons grade uranium. It has to have the right isotopes. So now you have to get it into the right materials first. So that's the isotopic content as well as the chemical content. Then you got to make sure that all of the things that get into it, the contaminants that happen in that process, get separated out, because the metallurgy matters. Because bad metallurgy will result in things, and you can think of just like with other metals, if you have steel and it has pits or whatever, or contaminants in it, it's going to rust. It's going to not function the way you expect it. And these designs for these weapons are built to such incredible tolerances that you must make sure that contaminants are removed from that. So that process takes time. A lot of chemists, by the way. Thank you, all you chemists out there in our audience that do all this hard work. Okay. And oh, and by the way, when all this is happening, remember the plutonium is radioactive. Okay. It emits alpha particles that can be absorbed into lungs. Of course, it can fission, so it emits neutrons. So now, thank you, all you safety people out there. And thank you, all you mechanical engineers out there that build the systems that can move this plutonium around from station to station without harming people as this is done. Because we want to show our adversaries not only we're serious about building nuclear weapons, but we're not going to die doing it. We're going to do it in the best fashion possible, which is what the United States does. Then once you get, so back to my story, once you get to the plutonium of the right, you know, you get the plutonium, which you have to make, then you have the plutonium of the right grade, which you have to make, then you have the reduction of contaminants that you have to make, then you have to do all the metallurgy to get it in the right form and everything else. Then you have to cast it and form it, and then you have to test it, analyze it to make sure it's right. Because as this article points out, we can make, if we make 80 pits, which was what you said, by 2030, not all 80 pits are going to be, you know, the right way. There are going to be some that just don't cut the mustard. And so now you have to make more. And so, because they can't go into a weapon, they can't be non-reliable, they can't not function in the way the DOD wants them to, because that's what the NNSA promises when we turn those weapons over to the DOD. You're going to get this yield, you're going to have this timing, you get this output, and it's going to function this way. What an incredible system. So that's why I was fascinated when I saw that we have a pit, and at least according to the article, I've not gotten any outside response on this, but according to this pit that was designed is a pit that as first weapon-ready example. So there, when I say that, there are obviously other that probably weren't weapon-ready that were designed, developed, and everything else as we learned the process again. And the manufacturing process is not just simple metallurgy. It's got a lot of steps. Does that get you there?
No, that's absolutely. That's great. And I want to you know, give credit to the author in the article here. This, the article that we're talking about is by Howard Altman of thewarzone.com or twz.com. I think it is. .com. And the article is first plutonium pit for a nuclear warhead produced in the U.S. in 35 years is now weapon ready. So I think to your point that the title sort of gives it away that there may have been a few more, but they weren't quite, you know, they weren't quite ready to go. And I think that's fascinating. And of course, the goal is 80 pits by 2030. So that's another 6 years. So it took us 6 years to get to one pit. Will we get to 6 years for the other 79? And then will we be on the 80 per year at that point? How do we do this faster?
Yeah. So, you know, that's, I was actually prepared to answer that question. I do want to take one step back to the article that as much as I appreciate this article by Howard Altman, and I don't know him personally, but I would say in the article, I don't think he had to mention, I believe three, maybe more times, that the Sentinel program is over budget and behind. Okay. And, you know, that mentioning it once maybe was important. We all know this is a long project and budgets are changed. Inflation is going to change. I just wanted to point that out, but we're still moving forward. And I think that's the important piece. And we could talk about budgets another time. So getting back to the pits, will we get to 80 by that time? And I thought, how can I give our listeners a way of thinking about this? So let's think, I live in Ohio. You know, car manufacturing is big here. So let's just say there's a Ford plant, I believe, up in the northern part of Ohio. So let's say Ford decided to just shut down for 30 years. And then all of a sudden they'd say, let's start manufacturing cars again. Okay. How, you know, when they roll off that first one, it's going to take a long time to build the background. You know, my Petrosky's, you know, standard answer for those that have been in classes with me know that I always say, how long does it take to build a 15-year expert? It takes 15 years. You might shorten it by changing the way you do it, but you have to build the expertise. You have to build the facilities. You have to build the infrastructure. As I said, we have to build safety and safety standards. I'm not saying they were laxed before, but the United States has a lot of safety logistics overhead built into the pits. And the manufacturer, for good reason, bad reason you want to say, but good reason to make sure we're safe. And all of that's built in and taken into account in the making of these pits. So I wouldn't say it's probably not going to be an exponential rise or, it's going to rise, doubling time or tripling time, but it's not going to be linear. I think, you know, we make one today, maybe four, four maybe in the next couple of years. And I'm just throwing numbers out there to give an example. Then maybe 20, then maybe, 30. We're going to come up to a sustainable level. And you're going to have a sustainable level of input and you have a sustainable level of output. And I want to go backwards here to something I said before. And that is that you have to have a manufacturing capability for the plutonium. That means you have to have a feedstock that goes into the system that fills the feedstock that isn't coming out. So again, think of it like a plunger. You got to fill it with water first, and then eventually the water comes out the other side. Same thing for the plutonium. You got to manufacture a lot of it, put it in, get the system loaded with all the pieces, but then they start coming out. Or in my car example, you got to have all the fenders and tires and everything else. Eventually you have all the pieces of a car in place and a car poops out the other side, comes out the other side of the manufacturing process. So there you go.
Oh, excellent.
What a legend.
That's a good one. I understand the idea. And I want to also point out to the audience how disappointed I am that Jim tried to sell me a stock in his plutonium mines, trying to take advantage of my ignorance in that regard. So let's just be a lesson to all you listeners. There are no plutonium mines of which you should be buying stock in.
Yeah, but I'm not buying that stock back, my friend. It's a fine.
Okay, so I wanted to ask, it's not really in the article, but I know it was mentioned in the article, but it's not really part of the pit per se. But I wanted to ask you about the continued use of the tritium, deuterium,
deuterium.
Deuterium gases that do the boosting. And why is this going to be a part of the new system? Is it mandatory that it's that way? I was kind of hoping we might be able to get past that older technology.
Well, I mean, there's not. So first of all, deuterium and tritium are the fusion gas that are used in the secondaries, that are the boost gas that allow this weapon to function as it should, and allows you to get, very, very high yields from the weapon itself. The secondaries, the primaries in the weapon. And the reason why you want to do the deuterium tritium boost gas in the primary is because you're basically trying to squish this down as small as possible. And the fusion gas, as you would expect with a gas, is a whole lot easier to squish down than a solid. So that's why you go with a gas. Now, the problem with deuterium and tritium gas, of course, is deuterium and tritium are also radioactive. And when I say radioactive, you can think of them being unstable. So take any of my classes, that's how I explain radioactivity. I say something becomes unstable and it gives off stuff to become stable. So deuterium and tritium, they are unstable And because they're unstable, they decay over time. And so they must be replenished in the system as it's operated. So there's no other real easy way to do this, because remember the primary, the fission primary, which has, you know, has these plutonium pits, is driven by a chemical explosion. And so, you know, it's not as much energy as you get to drive the secondary. So that's sort of the meat of it all. There's no easier way to do this. I mean, this has been studied for a long time. So yeah. I don't look at it as old technology. I mean, you might say using plutonium and uranium are old technology. And my answer would be, come up with some better way to do it. I'd like to hear you. And so those are the ways in which the weapon functions. That, you know, but it does again point to the importance of maintenance of this. I'm going to go back to an article that you and Adam wrote on dynamic parity, and that is that in dynamic parity, you speak of maintaining a manufacturing capability because we have had to replenish the deuterium and tritium in the current stockpile as well as the future stockpile. We actually have a capability of doing that already in place, unlike the plutonium pits, which we just completely stopped doing. And, you know, again, use my manufacturing thing. You completely stop manufacturing something, wait a period of time, and then try to build all the expertise to do it. It takes a while. And that's great that we're beyond that.
Well, something we are not beyond are the legal challenges. So, you know, as the NNSA has determined 30 pits per year will come out of the Los Alamos National Laboratory and 50 pits out of the Savannah River site. Mm-hmm. Both have come under legal scrutiny, if you will, and like clockwork. Just a couple of days ago here, again, in the early October timeframe of 2024, the NNSA was taken to court for failing to properly evaluate its expansion of plutonium pit production in South Carolina and New Mexico in violation of environmental regulations. A federal judge has ruled this from an AP article. Written by Morgan Lee, called titled U.S. Nuclear Weapon Production Sites Violated Environmental Rules, Federal Judge Decides. So the defendants are saying that, I'm sorry, the plaintiffs are saying that the defendants, which would be the government, neglected to properly consider combined effects of their two-site strategy of using both the sites in both those two states, and have failed to convince the court that they have somehow accounted for those effects on the environment, and that they had used an outdated environmental impact study. This surprises me, Jim, because the Biden administration is certainly very sympathetic to the environmental protection, environmental issues, environmental causes, and these sorts of things. I would think that if any administration would do this safely and securely and without question, it would be the Biden administration. But some of the co-plaintiffs, such as Nuclear Watch New Mexico and some others, some other indigenous tribes and so forth around the country, seem to have other ideas here. Do you think that there's something to say? I know that there were problems at Rocky Flats that shut that down in the late 80s. There have been some other issues with environmental compliance at the labs in the past. I assumed a lot of that was cleaned up by now. Is this a valid issue, or is this really just lawfare being waged by environmentalists or anti-nuclear disarmament advocates just seeking to slow this process down?
Yeah, well, certainly the oversight is important. I mean, because there are incredible environmental consequences for not being careful, for not doing the right thing. You mentioned, and I wish I could go back and look at the transcripts, and maybe you'll look because you're reading and leaving me completely by myself to answer a question for which the real nibble of this was way back in paragraph one. And that is that you said that they they went against environmental regulation, and you thought the Biden administration was making sure that this was secure and safe. Regulation isn't necessarily there to ensure you are secure and safe all the time. And I don't say that, you know, I don't say that tongue in cheek. The regulations have a lot to do with oversight and management, et cetera. And if you break a regulation is broken, for example, you can break a regulation by not filing a piece of paper in the right place. It's happened to me. I was a radiation safety officer, and I won't go into detail on this podcast. I'll just say it was a cathartic event. I labeled a piece of paper and renamed it something else, and we couldn't find it because I saved it digitally. That's the way it is. But I broke a regulation. But it didn't make me any less safe. It didn't leave me any less secure. What it did say, though, is that I was somewhat, I don't know, I guess you say I was lackadaisical in the way I named this file, but it certainly didn't lead to any grand consequences. And so these legal issues, you need strong leadership to be able to step in and call the shots. And we have to have a priority in the United States with the understanding that everything we do can have an environmental impact. You pull oil out of the ground, you have an environmental impact. You build a solar cell, you have an environmental impact. You build plutonium pits, you're going to have an environmental impact. And the question is, what is the risk compared to what is the reward in doing this? And what we have as a country and our leadership has to decide is the risk of making plutonium pits from an environmental standpoint different than the environmental impact of a war if we're not prepared to fight, because we see it as a deterrent. So I flip that around in the way it's looked at. So I now do I agree with these laws? Yeah, the laws are the laws. We make the laws of the land, and we need solid, strong leadership to set those priorities. We also need solid, strong leadership to step in when we need to step in on these kind of issues to make sure that we do not damage our credibility in making these weapons. And other countries don't have those kind of oversight. And I can go into it. You go into it that way. We can go into it from a logistics standpoint. There's a lot of things that we do in our country to make it right. But I did peruse down to the comment section on this article. And I do have to, Lost Engineer is the name of the person that made his comment. I just thought it was, he said there's an easy answer for this. The engineer to lawyer ratio in the U.S. is approximately 1.38, and a lawyer can create a headache in 10 minutes that will take an engineer weeks to solve. I just thought that was an interesting comment. One of the responses to this article. So got people talking. So that's a good thing.
No doubt about it. No doubt. I mean, you can have an environmental impact just washing your car in the driveway and letting the soap run down into the street, right? So yeah, this is always going to have issues. And as we are looking at our national priorities, we have to see where we can where I don't want to say compromise. I'm not trying to say that we should compromise laws or safety or any of those things, but we need to find ways to get to the happy medium. It should not be about shutting down the national effort of what needs to be done. It should be about making sure that it's done properly, but not that it's stymied in some way. And so I think because our adversaries are not slowing down. And so the last thing I want to bring up here before we close out, Jim, is again, in this same early October timeframe, boy, it's busy. Pick any 2 weeks out of the year, and there's three or four issues that are worthy in our wheelhouse, so to speak, here at NIDS. So there was apparently an incident in Iran on the 6th of October. That was Saturday, where a tremor was sensed, a 4.4 magnitude "quote unquote" earthquake was sent. But there's some speculation here that it was possibly an attempted nuclear test, underground nuclear test, in a site yet unknown, so to speak, to the outside world inside of Iran. And so, of course, the social media and the internet and was just going nuts, so bonkers over this, if you will, speculating that Iran just went nuclear, that they just completed a successful test. There's some speculation. There was a great article in First Post that earthquake or nuclear test, question mark, what's behind the mysterious tremors in Iran? And it really lays out, you know, I think a fairly good explanation about tremors and the fact that this thing was only 12 kilometers, which may be fairly shallow, and so forth. 10 kilometers, consistent with natural seismic effects, but it's also close enough that you would expect it from an underground explosion. And so it kind of goes through the arguments on both sides, and it sort of comes to the conclusion here that the verdict is that the evidence remains inconclusive as to whether or not. I think what would be interesting to know is was there any radiation detection that might have come out at some point to figure this? The timing is curious. Of course, this happened several days after a second ballistic missile attack on Israel. Israel threatening to retaliate, having a test that you can't necessarily hide from the rest of the world is an interesting communication means by a state that that is purportedly within days, weeks, or months of producing, you know, a dozen weapons, and has already sort of weaponized the threat to build weapons in its coercive diplomacy. So the timing is just really odd. And I wondered, Jim, if you had any comment from your expertise as to what your thoughts were on whether or not this was an earthquake or a test.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, so let me start out by saying correlation is not causation. So we got to be very careful of that. And so so let me back up and sort of give our listeners, because it sort of is an interesting thing to do, a little bit of information on the seismic kinds of attribution work that goes on for nuclear tests. So when a nuclear weapon goes off underground, it couples to the surrounding material and creates a shock wave that travels along the surface of the earth and can travel down into the earth. And the waves that are created are created in a very specific way, in a certain time domain, if you will, in a certain frequency domain, unlike most earthquakes. Now, some earthquakes, you know, it's very hard to sort this out. Someday we're going to talk about AI, because I did an AI project with one of my master students that happened to be in Alaska at the time. And he just happened to pick up a seismic signal that just happened to be the one from the North Korean tests. So we actually observed that. So I had a little opportunity to see how that works. And we built an AI, a data analysis system, brought out. So he was a successful student. Okay, back to this. So we know a lot about seismic activity, not just from a nuclear weapons test. You know, most people I've talked to since they've heard about this go, well, you know, we only had so many tests. How do we know what's going on? But remember, we are monitoring seismic activity in the world from the U.S. Geological Survey System, USGS, and I would recommend a lot of people go there. They're going to probably flood the site from all of our listeners here. if you go to earthquake@usgs.gov, you can see how many monitoring stations and how many earthquakes happen every day. And the probability one happening in Iran at this time, especially in Iran, there are a lot of faults that occur in Iran. If you look at an annual number of earthquakes that come from Iran, they're a fairly sizable number. And the probability one occurring at that time is fairly good. You know, it's going to happen on some day. It had to happen on that day. The other thing is, and you saw it there, and I looked at the USGS survey. And again, if you go to earthquake.usgs.gov, you can see the thousands and thousands of earthquakes that happen every day. It's not an uncommon occurrence. And in fact, if you look in, you know, just the last couple of days, or if you look at the last 7 days, you'll see the earthquake that they mentioned in Iran. You can see the USGS at 10 kilometers. Now, 10 kilometers, that's a deep explosion. I do not see that as being a weapon test. What would you get out of a test that deep? How would you build and bore and everything else? What kind of, you know, what kind of evidence would you have in boring a hole that deep, and what kind of value would you get out of such a test aside from dropping it in a hole and letting it detonate? So I don't see this as being a test. I think it's a little much to do about nothing. I'll get back to except for one thing that's really important here. And if you think, well, all seismic tests, they all look about 10 kilometers. You know, look at Alaska, for example, recently, because they get a lot of surface seismic shots. And we are able to co-locate those with seismic sensors that are all around the world. And in fact, from the standpoint of nuclear testing and even underground testing, we do a lot of seismic analysis at USGS for earthquakes that happen under the water to be able to predict tsunamis so that we can give alerts. So that we know where they're happening. We can geolocate them. We can depth locate them because of the type of wave. There's P wave and S wave. And I'm not going to get into the grand the physics of that, but those waves indicate what's happening and the type of compressions that occurred. So in Petrosky's view of what was released, I don't see this as much of a test shot and just bad timing. Now let me give the tidbit on the other side though, but it does show the value of strategic communication. Something like this, if it did happen, what would it say? What if we were to set off a detonation underground? What would it say? And what are the other indicators it would provide for an adversary to say we're serious? And going back to our previous subject, we are very serious in strategically communicating that we are going to build pits. You didn't think we would, even though there's those legal issues going on. We've moved forward. We've built a pit. We've done it. Now I got to build 79 more. That is an incredible feat to talk about it in strategic communication. And I don't know if I went where you were hoping I'd go, but that's my true analysis having looked at these, just looking at the time domain, looking at the frequency domain. It's very hard to look at. And if you have, there's some real advances that also show their ionics, you know, ionospheric disturbances and radiological, as you said, releases from underground tests that will show up to really do a sort of a two phenomenology kind of a attribution to such a detonation. And none of those have come out. So again, I ask our audience, go look at that region, look at a year's worth of seismic activity in the region. It happens a lot more, earthquakes do. And that becomes, you know, whether good or bad, becomes what it is, but we're monitoring all the time. And that's good because no one's going to get away with it without us monitoring. And I thank the people that do that attribution and monitoring for that service. That's a big
part of what we do. So this goes to this idea of deterrence by detection, which the Biden administration has proffered as having some success. I'm not sure yet, but your answer is interesting. I'll, you know, full disclosure to the audience, I did not know what your answer was going to be. So I'm glad that the pessimist in me says that this is something that they would have could have done. That they would do it too deep. Wouldn't surprise me, burdening nuclear powers screw things up all the time, and going too deep thinking that they would hide it is certainly within the realm of the possible. I think what kind of assistance they might be getting from their three best friends that are all nuclear powers, actually four if you want to consider Pakistan. And so they've got a lot of possible assistance and advice. And so, I'm always a little suspicious, but I do appreciate your opinion and your learned explanation on that for me and our audience. So fantastic work, Jim. So we're going to wrap things up here. We are getting folks home. It's coming to the end here, but I do want to just impress upon everybody again, just how much what an important feat we've reached here in the nuclear enterprise, producing that first pit. I've made jokes in the past, I should say, that if we can't do them, we should buy some from North Korea because they seem to be able to do it. And Russia claims they'll do 1,000 a year. And who knows, they might be able to do that. They certainly aren't going to worry about the same safety issues, or federal judges, when they're trying to do their portion. You have an, by the way.
Yeah. But I want to caveat that on a different vein though. If we have safety issues in our in our production. I mean, severe. I mean, imagine tomorrow a nuclear weapon accidentally went off inside of one of our facilities. Our nuclear programs would be dead. I mean, people would not tolerate that. We saw that in the nuclear industry. We're just finally seeing a resurgence in reactors. And so my point to that is we do it safely as part of our deterrent to show that we are darn, almost said your bad word, darn well serious that this is what we mean. And we're going to do it safely, right way, and we're serious about it. And I hope we continue here. Like I said, it's a positive to me.
Well, this needs to be a national priority, and it should be not only that, it should be bipartisan, nonpartisan, however you want to couch it. America has an interest in preserving peace and security and tranquility across the world, ensuring a stable world that averts major war. And we have to be able to parry the rising nuclear challenge that our adversaries are doing. 3 decades of attempting to lead by an example of denuclearizing, for lack of a better description, has not worked. And so it is time for America to pivot. One way to do that is to pivot, and we'll keep moving forward in that direction. Thanks, Jim, for lending us your expertise. I want to remind our listeners to check us out on our webpage at thinkdeterrence.com. Hit us up on LinkedIn, Twitter X. Our handle is at thinkdeterrence. As well, we're on Getter. And then check out GSR, Global Security Review, GSR.com, for reading any of the articles and commentaries that folks are producing, and some thought pieces that might stir some thought as you individually think about these issues in national security. So again, thank you so much. And as we wrap up the event, I always want to remind our listeners to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.